thank you very much for the invitation. I'm really glad to be able to talk to you today. I feel like I might be losing my voice a bit, so please, if you can't hear something I say, don't be shy about interrupting. I'm a professor at Cal State Fullerton. I'm part of our Gravitational Wave Physics and Astronomy Center. Here's a picture from, I think this is two summers ago now. We've got about 20 students currently, and about 20 graduates of our program. We have three professors, and then here's Marissa Walker, who's our first postdoc, except I need to update this slide because she just accepted a faculty offer at a university in Virginia, so she'll be heading there next. Our center is about doing research and education and outreach in gravitational waves. So besides the students here in our research lab, I've been doing teaching an undergraduate general relativity course that they didn't have before that's new, and I got some inspiration, you can guess, from one of the professors here who's had some impact on it. So what I want to talk to you about today are I'll bring you up to speed on the latest news from the gravitational wave observations. I'll tell you about how numerical relativity is playing some roles that's sort of threaded through this whole story. And I'm also going to tell you, from time to time, you'll see students popping up on the slides where I mentioned some work that our students have done in the research lab. So that's sort of what I want to tell you about today. And we couldn't do any of this work without some really generous support from National Science Foundation and others. Okay, so I'm going to start out laying a bit of background for what are gravitational waves. So this is a picture of two little black holes. They're the little throats there in the middle, spiraling together and merging. And as they merge, they send out these ripples of curved space and time. This is all in slow motion. These are traveling outward at the speed of light. These are gravitational waves. These ripples in curved space and time will stretch and squeeze space and time as they travel. So in this animation, the stretching and squeezing is 20%. And you can imagine, imagine trying to build this. So this is basically what gravitational wave detectors like LIGO are doing. You take a mass up here and a mass here, and when a gravitational wave comes into the screen, it will stretch and squeeze the masses, but nothing like this much. It actually, the loudest waves that we can observe are more like 10 to the minus 21. So to give you a perspective, if the arms on this thing, the radii of this circle, were the size of our detectors, 4 kilometers, then the stretching and squeezing is less than 1/1000th the size of a proton. It's down around 10 to the minus 18 meters. So in order to detect the loudest gravitational waves that are out there, we have to start by making the most sensitive length measurement ever done. Sure.
Do we know how much of a gravitational wave we can tolerate as human?
That is a wonderful question. That is a wonderful question. This comes back to, unfortunately, this question has been explored in, you know, the Middle Ages. It's how much stretching and squeezing humans can survive. So 10 to the minus 21 is not a problem. 0.2, I wouldn't do it. I think that's probably lethal. You don't get up to order 10 to the minus 1 unless you're very near the source. Like, you know, if it's two black holes, then within, you know, maybe 10-ish Schwarzschild radii, something around there. Like, you got to be right in the vicinity to feel that. Even if you're as far away as, like, the sun, the waves fall off as 1/radius, and it's small enough, you know. You might feel a little something if it's somewhat far away. But, yeah, basically, you've got to be, if you're close enough, it's bad for you. But for all practical sources, there's other radiation that you should worry about first. Okay. And yeah, please feel free to interrupt if you have any questions about anything. So that's a picture of what the idea is of what we want to do. We want to measure these little ripples. They're so weak when they get to Earth because the sources are so far away. I should also say this isn't just a cartoon. This is a movie showing the curvature. Actually, these waves out here are just the It's the Newman-Penrose scalar psi-4, if you've looked at the Newman-Penrose formalism. It's just showing the gravitational waves. And this calculation and movie were done by one of our undergrads on our little supercomputer at Cal State Fullerton. Okay, so how are you going to do this? If you want to actually detect the stretching and squeezing when it's not at painful levels, but it is at this tiny, tiny amount. So this is a movie that I like to show because it simplifies the detector to the point where a theorist like me can kind of understand it. So the idea here is, this is supposed to be a laser, and this is a half mirror, so half the light bounces off and half goes this way. And then it hits a mirror, this is 4 kilometers away, and then when the light comes back, then it's a half mirror again, and so some of the light can get through here, but it's all out of phase, so the camera here isn't picking any light up. But if a gravitational wave comes by like this and starts stretching and squeezing the light, then this perfect destructive interference is broken, and then you get a little bit of a signal. So that's sort of the gist of how these things work. The whole art of it, and why it took decades to make it happen, is dealing with all the other things that can stretch and squeeze the detectors and driving the noise low enough that you actually can pick out this signal from everything else. Okay. So on September 14, 2015, so this was 9:50 in the morning UTC, so in Louisiana at this detector here, it was 4:50 in the morning. the story I heard was that they were doing some, okay, well I'll just say that they weren't yet ready to officially start their science run on this day. What happened was they were doing some tests during the day and then they'd go home at night. And I think they were working on this, I don't remember the exact time, but like till fairly late one night, and then they went home, but overnight they'd let it run just like as if it were the science run. And then a few hours after they went home, this first gravitational wave came by and hit the detectors. So that wave had been traveling for a billion years from its source, and it got to these detectors, the first week that they were capable of detecting it. So this is a graph showing what the detector saw. This is that fractional stretching and squeezing from the little cartoon I had on the previous slide. This is all noise. But here, where you start seeing some oscillations. This is the stretching and squeezing from the gravitational wave. And this plot shows the two detectors, the one in Livingston, Louisiana, and the one in Hanford, Washington, on top of each other, adjusted so that, it takes the wave time to travel from one to the other, and that's all corrected so that you can see the waves on top of each other. And that gives us confidence that this thing isn't just some local disturbance. These kinds of graphs I'll be showing a little bit. This is time versus frequency. So to understand this, when it gets brighter, that means it's louder. When it gets higher in frequency, it gets higher up here, and then this is time. So this is sort of this whoop, kind of a chirping sound, that just like on your ringtone. This is a visual way of picturing that. So this is the first gravitational wave observation that we saw. And by looking at how the amplitude of the wave and the phase of the wave changes versus time, and how the frequency of the wave changes versus time, you can infer something about the source. Then by comparing it with model gravitational waves, you can extract something about what the source was doing. So what made the waves? So here's a figure from that first paper. the top panel is showing these are apparent horizons of the two black holes, and these are a bit of their orbits as they spiral together and merge. These are two black holes from a numerical relativity calculation with masses and spins consistent with the observation. And then this middle part is showing the numerical relativity waveform from those black holes in the red curve, and the thick gray curve is a reconstruction from the observation, and it's thick because there's noise, so you don't know exactly what the wave was. But this is to show you that the relativity calculation agrees very nicely with the reconstruction from the data. Every step in this figure interpreting the source of the waves involves numerical relativity in some way. These horizons are shaded by their two-dimensional intrinsic Ricci scalar curvature, And I chose that because when we were working on the figure, not everybody in LIGO was really excited about having numerical relativity in the paper. And this was something that has some interesting physical information about the shape of the horizons, but also it looks like some 3D lighting. Like if so you don't have to know that it's numerical relativity. And it worked too well. Another numerical relativist, Carlos Lusto, emailed me and said, hey, you should take those cartoons out and put numerical relativity in. And I didn't say anything until like a year later, and then finally I fessed up to him. Yeah, it was numerical relativity the whole time. So, okay, so what I want to tell you about is in a little more detail, this is just one example of a figure, how do we use numerical relativity to understand what the gravitational wave detectors are observing?
Can I just go back? I think this
is a
simple point. I mean, before you showed a plot of the frequency as a function of time.
Yes.
Now, normally, you know, frequency is something you get by taking the time dependence in Fourier transform or something. So if you only have one cycle, I mean, okay, I can see a frequency for, you know, the early time.
Yeah.
But to see the chirp, it looks like you're somehow deriving a frequency from just one or two cycles. Is that right?
Yeah. So let me come back.
Period of this.
Let me come back to that other figure. That's a good question. So this is, this red curve is a theoretical waveform. So if you come back here, you can't really see too many cycles clearly in this view of the data.
Uh-huh.
But this is not the most accurate way that we have to recover what's underneath the noise. This signal happened to be loud enough that with just filtering out some other frequencies, you could actually see some of the cycles visibly. But you don't need that in order to see more of what's there. In particular, you can do things like matched filtering, where you take basically a dot product of a wave against the data, and you can recover more cycles that way than what you can see here. Also here, this is a time versus frequency. So when you do this time versus frequency, there's some discretization in the data in time, and then you know, you divide it up into some bins to say, well, what how much do you have in each frequency at just this little bit of time? This all looks smooth, but really, you could imagine this as a bunch of little blocks, like a little rectangle here for this much time. How much power was in this frequency range?
So Gary's question is, what kind of?
Yeah, maybe I don't understand.
What basis function are you using to describe this? When you say time versus frequency, there's something that's inherently ambiguous there. Are you using window functions that always include seven oscillations at the beginning?
Yeah, that's a good question. So,
they don't have it, right? To see the chirp, it looks like you're deducing a frequency for each cycle or something.
Maybe three cycles.
So it's not necessarily each cycle. I know they normally use a Welch window when they're but I don't know exactly. I don't know exactly what. I know they have a few different versions. I'm not quite sure which variant this one that I'm showing you is. So I'm sorry. I'll have to look into it. Okay. So once you've done something that I'll talk in a little more detail how it works later to compare this data more quantitatively to some model waveforms that are tuned to numerical relativity, you can infer what the masses of the black holes are. And these black holes, these waves came from two massive objects with roughly these masses spiraling together and merging. And then they left behind a smaller black hole. Now, we weren't able to measure the like quasi-normal ringing and the ring down well enough to get this number. This number saying that, you know, we've lost three solar masses to gravitational waves comes from numerical relativity. We measure the initial masses, and then you can say for those masses what gets sent out. How much gets radiated, and you can calculate that. So then you can also infer by how loud it is. You can calculate from, if you had black holes like this, how strong would that stretching and squeezing be right near the source? And it would be about 0.4 in these units. So that's to the place where, that would be bad for you. But then you can use how loud it actually was, about 10 to the minus 21, to get an idea of what the distance is. and that's where how we know it's about a billion light years away. So this is just that's just the first thing that we've seen. This is what's new. Last month we announced LIGO announced all the detections that they've made in their first two observation runs. The last one concluded in August 2017, but it took us a year to go through the data and do things like what I was describing, like this idea of comparing different chunks of the data to different template waveforms, model waveforms, to see what's in there. And these are the signals we ended up seeing. So again, so I'm not completely sure exactly which of these different methods they used to do the Fourier transform here, but this is to give you this is what the data looks like. So this is time, and this is frequency. And each of these panels here show the gravitational wave stretching and squeezing down here, and then the time frequency, so the chirping that the wave would make right above it. Most of them, we didn't necessarily expect this to be true, but most of them are actually loud enough that that you can show them in this kind of a plot and actually see the data above at least some filtered noise. This one, you can't really see very well back here, but this one actually, because there's so many cycles in frequencies that LIGO can detect, because the mass of this one turns out to be smaller, this idea of matched filtering works very well, and so that's how we could be so confident it was there, even though this one you might say, well, you know, this one and this one, they don't necessarily look so convincing like some of these others.
Isn't it odd that half of those events happened in the last month?
Yeah. So LIGO worried about this. First of all, we were scheduled to shut down at the end of August, and there were some people who said, we should keep going. Look at all these black holes we're getting now. basically, we didn't, because the sensitivity gains to be had are so much that by shutting down and coming back on more sensitive, you see way more stuff than if you keep going at the sensitivity we were at before. But we worried about it, and people did some studies of what random, you know, Poisson statistics would say, and this is just at the edge of what could happen randomly based on their best guess. Now, I don't know all the details that went into that, but basically, if it were much worse than that, you might be suspicious, but this is consistent with randomness. We were starting to wonder, because we saw these two. So these, if you haven't seen these names, and yeah, we name them just GW and then the year, month, and day. So we saw these two signals. This one was Christmas in the US, but Boxing Day in the UK, so we named it 15, 12, 26. And then when we turned back on for the second observing run, we saw this one in January, and then 6 months, nothing. Then this one's in June, and then this is July 29th, August 9th, August 14th, August 18th, August 17th, August 23rd. So August and end of July, you know, it started raining gravitational waves and
stuff. Are they all black hole?
Almost all of these are black hole, except for that one. That's a neutron star, probably. I'll say more about this one in a few slides and why we're pretty sure it's two neutron stars colliding. The time scale also is quite different. That's one thing that gives it away. Basically, these waves are in the detector's sensitive frequency band less the more the mass. So here, this is like, you know, 4/10 of a second, this scale right here, but this is 40 seconds. So one reason why we suspect neutron stars is because this one's consistent with sort of one solar mass objects, whereas the others are more like 30 solar mass objects, or you know, 20 or something like that. Okay, so with this many black holes, we can start to learn something about what kinds of black holes are out there merging in binaries. So this is a movie that one of my students made to try to get some intuition about the different black holes. So she took these numerical relativity calculations and turned them into physical units and put them all together. So these are the black hole apparent horizons as they come to, the holes come together, merge, and then ring down. And then these are the gravitational waves. Really, they're just the L equals M equals 2 part of the wave, but that's the most significant part of the waves. So this gives you an idea of, the weaker ones, if they're farther away, that makes them weaker. They tend to be at, the ones that are moving around more slowly are larger, they have more total mass. Whereas gravitational waves like this one, there's a lot more cycles. They're moving around a lot faster. It's just There's just some scaling. It's just some scaling there with the two. When you rescale the space-time for two lower mass black holes, that just the waves just scale in this way. So this is just to give you an intuition of what these different black holes were doing. And then I can freeze this a bit so you can see how tidally deformed the black holes get right near merger. So I'm shading them by their curvature. When these colors are bright, that means that the black holes are strongly curved away from spherical when the colors are changing very strongly. And then right when the common horizons form, you see these very bright colors. So this red color is negative curvature. So that's like, you know, the middle of a peanut. And then these blue areas are like the peanut bulging on the edges. So these are the shapes of the black holes in these calculations. Now, that's not necessarily exactly what happened. These are just one calculation, each one that's within the error bars. But there's enough degeneracy that there's plenty of other simulations you could have done that would give you waves that look basically the same. OK, so what have we actually learned when you compare as carefully as you can the data with model waveforms? What we've learned is that there are black holes more massive than we thought existed for stellar mass black holes. So I didn't make this figure. Frank Alvesky from Northwestern made it. This is showing all the neutron stars and black holes of known mass, where we can get a good measure of what their masses are. So the neutron stars are down here, and the black holes are up here. The blue ones are the ones that LIGO's seen, and then these yellow ones are ones where they're in some binary that's emitting light, so you know matter's falling in, and you can estimate the mass that way. And so we sort of knew about these 10 to 20 solar mass black holes, but then like then these guys up here, you know, like 30 and 20 solar mass black holes merging. This is the first time we've seen those. Now, all these arrows show the kind of black hole that the merger created, or in this case, the two neutron stars created something more massive. But we haven't actually been able to measure what these masses are. These are inferred masses by saying, if you do a bunch of numerical relativity and say, okay, for any given masses, what kind of mass comes out, that's what you get. So that's where these upper black holes come from. So the most massive one that we've seen ended up merging into something 80 solar masses left behind.
The size of the disk is the mass?
The size. So the size is scaling with the mass. It's basically a scaled up Schwarzschild radius. Yeah, it's just, so the mass is larger both as you go up and as you get, by where they're placed, and also they're just drawn larger. But that's just the same thing.
What about the spin?
So this isn't saying anything about the spins. That's a wonderful question. I'll say more later about inferring the spin and what we can and can't say. It turns out there's one combination of the two black hole spins we can measure fairly confidently, and that combination is small. The other components of the spin we can't measure confidently, and we're not sure. But I'll say and show some plots in more detail in a bit.
Is there information in the left-right position?
No. It's roughly, I think it's just chronological, like these are the gravitational waves, and then these other ones, I don't know. No, left and right doesn't mean anything here. In fact, I'm going to resort it, and now it's just sorted from small to big. And then first, these are the galactic binaries, these purple ones. Well, small to big. I'm not sure exactly how they sorted it this time, but then these are all the mergers. So you can try to get some idea of what kinds of black holes are out there.
I'm sorry, extragalactic means outside the Milky Way or really not living in any galaxy?
I'm not sure. Outside the Milky Way is all I can say for sure. They're far, and that's only, I think this label here is only referring to these purple ones here. These are the ones that aren't known to be in our galaxy. And then these blue ones are the ones that LIGO's observed.
Oh, I see. You see blue.
So let me go back. So there's two different populations here. So there's the purple ones are black holes that we've measured with light, and you can break those into two groups, the ones in our galaxy and everything else. But I'm not saying whether the others are in galaxies or not. I'm actually not sure. I don't know where that came from. The LIGO ones definitely aren't in our galaxy because they're way too far away. Like the closest ones are still, you know, I don't know if not a billion light years, like hundreds of millions of light years away, way too far. Okay. So this is just one of the things that measuring these black holes is telling us. There was a grumpy professor I met once who said, okay, once you see one of these things, well, you know, what else is there to do? And one of the things that there is to do is to start learning what kinds of black holes are out there. We know that these are out there and they radiate loudly in gravitational waves, but as the detectors get more sensitive, it might be that they start revealing other populations of black holes that we haven't yet seen. And that's one of the things I'm really excited to see when the detectors turn back on in March, what they're going to see. But there's this other event. This involves neutron stars. It's farther outside my expertise, but it's too cool for me to pass up, so I have to say a little bit about this. So this is the time frequency plot, and you can see this chirp track where it's going up in frequency as it goes forward in time really clearly. The merger, when the two neutron stars are getting really close together, when they merge, that's right here at time zero when this thing's shooting up. 2 seconds later, Fermi picked up a gamma ray burst. This is just counts versus time, so then there's this big burst of gamma rays. So there's a few things you can do with that right away. If you can be sure that these came from the same event, then you could say, okay, what if these were emitted at, okay, so normally if these are coming from two neutron stars, the gamma rays won't be created until the neutron stars are close enough to actually merge and start like deforming in each other and tearing each other up. So if you say, okay, if this came 2 seconds later, maybe that 2 second delay is because it took some time to get the gamma rays going, but maybe that 2 second delay is, well, they were emitted at the same time, but the speed of light is different from the speed of gravity. You can use that to put a bound on how different those speeds are. And because of the distance, that bound is really, really small. It's 2 seconds difference over 130 million year travel time. So that's one thing that you can do just as soon as you have that observation. But you can do more if you could not just have, oh, there were some gamma rays, but like where on the sky did this come from? So this is a plot like the one I just showed you, but these are the two different LIGO detectors, and here's Virgo, a detector over in Italy. You can see these tracks in LIGO, but you can't really see anything in Virgo, and that turned out to be crucial because the LIGO, so the detectors are like microphones. They're broadly sensitive over large regions of the sky, but maybe there's a few dead spots where they're not very sensitive. The Virgo detector was sensitive enough that it could have detected these unless the source was in a specific place on the sky. So the fact that Virgo didn't see it helped us narrow down where to look. There was a small, relatively small for us, relatively large for regular astronomers region to look through, but with some cleverness of thinking, okay, which galaxy should we start looking at? They were able to find it. So there's this galaxy, NGC 4993, and here it was in April 2017, and here it was right after this happened. In August 2017, and here's this new thing that wasn't there before. And this has been observed in all different wavelengths. This has been just a gold mine for electromagnetic astronomy. It's just amazing that this worked so well, the very first neutron star mergers we had. We think it's neutron stars because these gravitational waves are consistent with small masses. You can't completely rule out that one of them was a black hole, but the fact that you see this light makes it more, is consistent with neutron stars. Now, if you know what galaxy this thing lived in, we can measure the galaxy's velocity. And knowing that these gravitational waves go as 1 over r lets us infer the distance. And you can combine those to get this blue curve for what the Hubble constant should be from that one measurement. It's not great. It's got plenty of spread, but the peak is right between these two other there's these two other measurements. So you get the velocity from the galaxy, the distance up there, and then these two other measures of the Planck constant that don't quite agree with each other in these vertical stripes here. LIGO's peak is sort of right in between. If you could do this again and get more measurements, then you could narrow this down and maybe say something about which of these is right. So merging neutron stars, these are numerical relativity calculations that I didn't have anything. These were done by the group at Japan, I think. But they're just to illustrate if the stars are smaller, they're more like black holes. They don't tidally deform as much, and the waves tend to reach a higher frequency before they merge. So these peaks will be closer together than down here. You can analyze using model waveforms to compare to the data how massive do you think the stars were, and what is the frequencies doing to try to put some bound on how stretchy the stars are, how much they get. Well, to put a bound on what size the star was. Like basically, if the frequency gets higher before the cutoff, that's telling you it's probably a smaller star, and if it's lower, it's probably a bigger star. And so I wasn't involved in all the details of this, but this is just saying, okay, here's the mass of a neutron star versus its size, and then these are regions where they inside these contours are the more likely regions. These curves are different models of the relation between the mass and radius of neutron stars, and some of these is consistent, and then this one's a little bit to the side.
These are different equations of state.
Yeah, these are different equations of state. The equations of state usually are written in terms of density and pressure, and this is mass radius, but it's just you just process it to get what does it say about mass and radius. So yeah, these are different equations of state. This is just one measurement. If we do this enough, we can start to even better constrain. Are there any equations of state we can rule out? Now, one last thing I want to say, just because some of our students working with Jocelyn Reed has something to do with this, they started asking very early after we saw that observation, they started asking, okay, when we're using model waves to compare with the data, do tides matter? Are we sensitive enough for tides to matter? So what this is showing is the waves are extended to some frequency where we decide, you know, okay, beyond this frequency, we're not sensitive enough anymore. The LIGO's noise is getting too big. And for sufficiently high frequencies, if our high frequency noise is good enough, then this is just saying how much do these two different kinds of model waves disagree. This is a model wave with no tides versus a model wave with big tides. And this one has weaker tides, so you'd have to go to a higher frequency to start to notice the difference. But this is saying that for some plausible model waves involving tidal effects, you could actually see a difference. This was a calculation, a figure that one of our students made, and this started laying the foundation for what eventually gave us set up the actual quantitative comparisons to estimate comparing with model waves what the tidal deformability of the neutron stars was. So stronger tidal deformability is basically the Love number going this way to the right, and then this is the mass ratio where these are equal masses and then more unequal as you go down, and then they can start making some statements. So that's a bit of an aside, but I just had to say something about this because it's unique. It's so far. It's the only two neutron stars we've seen. What I want to talk about now is a little more detail about some of the work my students and I have been doing modeling merging black holes. Okay, these are hard equations to solve because they're nonlinear. So if you take two black holes and put them together, you don't get the solution of the curved space-time for two black holes. There's no gravitational waves. Okay, so, but not only do you not get the solution, you can get much more interesting and richer dynamics, just like in fluid dynamics. So these are pictures that I borrowed from Kip. So before we had numerical relativity, we didn't know exactly what these would look like, but we knew that space-time is so nonlinear, you can imagine starting getting much more rich, turbulent dynamics near the time of merger compared to something like this, where maybe you perturb the black hole a little bit or perturb the lake a little bit, but it's a nice day. So numerical relativity is the only way we know to be able to deal with this kind of strongly nonlinear, stormy space-time. right near the time of merger, any approximation that we have breaks down. Now,
what is the middle picture supposed to mean? I mean, we've got two rotating black holes.
Yeah.
From the spirals coming off.
Yeah, so this is a cartoon from before we could make movies. The little black arrows are the spins, so the spins are misaligned. The blue arrows are the orbital angular momentum, so they're supposed to be going around that way. And then these red arrows are supposed to be the gravitational waves. Yeah, so it's trying to give you an idea that there's all those effects at once. Okay. So in 2005, Franz Pretorius solved this problem for the first time. So we had spherical solutions for black holes the same year. I'm still kind of blown away. So Schwarzschild was fighting in World War I, got Einstein's paper while he was out there in the battlefield and managed to come up with the Schwarzschild solution. It took a while to realize it was describing black holes. But you know, and then the spinning black hole solution from Kerr came in the 60s, and then it took until 2005 to get the solution for two black holes. I was in group meeting this time, and I was still too young to fully appreciate the significance, but I remember Franz coming in and saying he had a movie to show us, and we were all seeing the first time two black holes going around and merging and sending out gravitational waves. It's a little bit like when my parents told me, hey, watch the tearing the Berlin Wall down on TV. And I was like, okay, I don't get it. I didn't fully get it. But later I did, and I was glad I saw it, you know? Okay. So how do these simulations work? Well, since 2005, a bunch of groups have worked very hard and built a bunch of codes. And all of them except one use basically the same family of methods. And then I'm going to talk about the other one. So roughly speaking, one way that they're different is how they discretize things. Computers need things to be discrete, but space-time's continuous. So how do you approximate that? The easiest way to do it is to just lay down a bunch of grid points and say, okay, here's the Riemann tensor components or the metric components at this point, this point, this point. And if you want to take a derivative, you can just say, well, the derivative here is this point minus that point divided by the distance between them. And you can do higher order versions of that that involve more points. But as you involve more and more points, when you have lots of processors you're running on, the communication costs start to matter. And I'll say more about that later. The way we do this is different. We divide the space-time up into regions, like a little spherical shell around the black hole. Like you see this little half, I've cut it open so you can see it, this little shell here. And we sum, and we expand everything we want to know, like the metric, the space-time metric, in terms of some basis functions we know. So that way, if you want to know derivatives, you don't have to do something like this where you look at other points. You know the derivatives of your basis functions. They're just polynomials that you know, or, you know, in a sphere, spherical harmonics. And then you take the derivatives analytically. It turns out that this method this method has some advantages. It turns out if the solution's smooth, this is more accurate at less cost. Basically, as you add more terms to these series expansions, you get exponential convergence. So you get closer to the true solution exponentially. Whereas over here, as you add more grid points, it's polynomial. So these codes can get more accurate. However, they need the solution to be smooth, so that rules out matter, where you have a surface of a star, something like that.
Harmonic evolution means harmonic gauge?
So there's a few things going on here. So generalized harmonic evolution is the formulation of the Einstein equations. It's inspired by the harmonic gauge, basically. But it's not saying that you're necessarily in harmonic gauge. In reality, we let the computer, we have some equations that determine numerically what the actual gauge will be. Sometimes you can evolve in harmonic gauge, but often you don't want to. If the black holes are spinning really fast, for instance, harmonic gauge actually squishes the horizons down to be flat, and that's troublesome numerically, so we usually use something else. But this is referring to the formulation of the equations, not the gauge.
What do you do for excision?
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. So right here, you can see we've cut out holes where the singularities are. Over here, if you're doing a finite difference code, basically you can work in some suitable coordinates so the singularity is just at some point and just turn off the grid point if it gets near there. But for this kind of thing, you're doing these series expansions over these big regions. You can't just turn off a point because really you don't have points. You have functions over some region, so you have to cut out these holes. The way we can do that and make it mathematically well posed, we have to make sure that everything is going out of the domain down into the black hole through these boundaries, and no characteristic fields, is a technical way to say it, is coming back in. And that turns out to get dicey when the spins are fast, which I'll say later if I get to it.
These elliptic equations is just for setting up the initial data.
That's right. a few people have speculated about trying to solve for the full space-time at once with one big elliptic solve, but nobody's done it. So in practice, we make initial data and then step forward in time with hyperbolic equations. Okay, so that's just a little bit about these two different methods. Now, it's not enough to just solve one merging black hole, because different black holes will make different gravitational waves. There's seven parameters we have to worry about: the ratio of the masses and the spins, the spin vectors of each hole. So here's a little animation that is based on interpolated numerical relativity. So you can watch these spin arrows process around as the two horizons, these little circles here, get closer together. And you can watch the orbital angular momentum process around a little bit. This is a lot. If you wanted to cover a seven-dimensional space with seven parameters, just three in each dimension, that's thousands. And just running one of these can take weeks on a supercomputer. So, so one of the challenges is just there's a lot of different kinds of black holes to worry about. In particular, when the masses are very unequal, that's trouble for us. It's trouble because of not the physics, but just numerical stability. It turns out when you're stepping forward in time with hyperbolic equations like the wave equation, so the generalized harmonic formulation of the Einstein equations makes the equations look like wave equations plus all these other messy terms, but part of it is wave equation-like. So basically, as you step from time to time, the time step has to be small enough that light can't travel between your nearest grid points. If you were to take a bigger time step so that the grid points could causally talk to each other between time steps, then errors can start blowing up exponentially. So this is called the CFL limit. And as a result, when the one black hole is much smaller than the other, then in order to resolve that, we need to put have more resolution, so the points get much, much closer together. And as a result, you're just taking these little baby time steps for no good reason for the physics, but just because otherwise your numerics go bad. So this means if you want to do mass ratio 10, that's going to take you five times longer than doing mass ratio 2. And that's a problem. So one possible thing you can do is try a different kind of time algorithm to step forward in time that involves solving elliptic equations at each step of the hyperbolic equations. And here's a result from a few years ago when I was a postdoc, where we found for a perturbed black hole, the time step size was basically the same when the black hole was ringing really, really fast, but then as it started settling down, the time step could get much bigger using this alternative method. And this is blue one's the one that's bound by this limit, and so you're forced to take these dumb tiny time steps when you don't really need them. Except you do need them just for stability, not for, or for numerical accuracy, not for physics. Okay. Also, when you have a little black hole, you might remember when I showed the movie, those little black holes can get really non-spherical in the right before merger, and that makes excision hard. It's hard to come up with a surface where everything's, all the characteristics are flowing down out the black hole. High spin is something that I've thought a lot about. This is my favorite black hole in the world because when they estimate its spin by looking at the matter falling in, this is an X-ray picture of it, the estimates are pretty high. There's a lot of uncertainty depending on how you model it, so it's not completely sure this one's spinning fast, but I like to think it is. At least it hasn't been ruled out yet. my favorite fictional black hole is that one from Interstellar because it was spinning at like 0.99999 in order to get that dramatic time dilation. That one stands out at me because I've taught time dilation to my students for years, but I never really felt so sad about it until I was watching Interstellar. If you haven't seen it, it's the most moving time dilation in a movie you've ever seen. The big problem for us for high spin, first of all, the elliptic equations you have to solve get way more complicated, as it turns out. I don't know of a good intuitive reason to explain why. It's just the usual way people make initial data can't make black holes faster than 0.93 spin. And that might not that might seem close to one, but as you increase the spin from 0.9 to 1, the space-time starts changing very non-linearly as you increase the spin. There's a big difference between a spin of 0.93 and 0.99. To try to evolve them, excision is just a nightmare. Basically, you have to choose a shape that's just inside the horizons, because if it's outside the horizon, you're going to have stuff flowing both ways, and that numerically it's not well posed. You have to have some boundary condition. Well, what's coming onto the grid? But it has to be just not too far inside the horizon either. We think that might be because there's an inner horizon getting very close to the outer horizon, but we're not completely sure. What we know is just empirically, if you squint, you might be able to see this little blue line that's the inner boundary just inside this horizon. If we don't ever so delicately continuously deform and adjust where these cutout holes are to track the black holes, then we get ill-posed equations with stuff trying to come up out of the black hole onto the computational grid. And that's what makes this such a pain.
So what happens when you collide black holes numerically? You know, when you collide them numerically, is it easy to make something where the final black hole has chi greater than 0.93 or some such thing?
Oh, that's a nice, a nice question. I don't have a slide for that today, but basically, it depends on the ratio of the masses. If you have a big black hole that's already spinning that fast and drop a little one into it, it can stay spinning that fast. For equal mass black holes, the opposite case, than if the black holes aren't spinning, but they have orbital angular momentum. They'll end up spinning at about 0.7 in the direction of the orbital angular momentum.
Independent of the original
spins. If the spins are zero, you get 0.7. Yeah. If they're both maximal with the orbital angular momentum, then you'll get something like 0.95. If they're opposite, you'll get 0.37. The orbital angular momentum always wins. It always points in that direction.
If you start with 0.9 aligned with the angular momentum, it tends to go up to 0.95.
The spin tends to go down until you get up a little above 0.9. So like two spin 0.8 black holes will merge to something a little bit less. Because it's the spin over the mass squared. So you've added angular momentum, but the mass has also increased. And so the spin over mass squared of the final one tends to go down until you get fairly high. So I guess I'm running a little low on time, so I'm going to skip that slide. I'm just going to show you one calculation of two black holes merging with masses and spins that are within the contours that you can draw by comparing the LIGO's first observation to a bunch of different model waves. Now, those waves aren't numerical relativity. That takes way too long to make all of them, but they're tuned, the models are tuned to numerical relativity in different places. Okay, and this took us 3 weeks. Basically, when I found out about this and I saw the observation, I kicked everyone off our computer at Fullerton, and my students and I started running calculations that ended up including this one. So this is the calculation. The wave looks a little weird because it's filtered. In order to actually see anything at all, when you just plot strain versus time, there's frequencies in LIGO's data where there's just noise. It's swamped by noise, and we had to filter those away. And as a result, that's why it doesn't ring down to nothing over here. There's just some weird filtering going on. But it's close enough that you could say, just as a first cut, what if I just try to subtract this wave from the data? What do I get? Well, you get something much less that looks like noise. This isn't the most careful way we can say this is consistent with relativity. This is just to give you a qualitative view of how big the order of magnitude of the residual would be. But you might say, well, how do you know your numerical relativity code is right? So when LIGO was saying, okay, we want to compare our wave with numerical relativity, but how do we know we can trust you? So one thing one of my students and I did is we started a new collaboration with RIT. We used to be competitors, and this sort of brought us together, and now we're really good. And we collaborated on this. We ran our codes, which had been developed for years, independently. We were competitors, so we didn't talk to each other very much. They use totally different formulations of the equations, different numerical methods, and we compared the waves at the end. This white curve here is the difference between our two curves for the same waveform compared to that order of difference between the wave and the data. Zooming in, this is the difference in amplitude, this thick black curve here, so it's less than 1%. It ends up being 1% right around the time of merger. And then this stuff over here doesn't matter because when the wave amplitude dies down to zero, you can't really make a fractional amplitude anymore. And then they agreed to within 1/10 of a radian of phase over something like 15 orbits, so 30 gravitational wave cycles. So this, when we saw this, these figures were made by one of my students who's now doing a PhD at Brandeis. And when we saw this, we breathed a big sigh of relief that our codes actually gave the same waves after, because we hadn't compared them in many years.
These are non-spinning.
They were line spin. So pretty slow spin. One spinning 0.3 like this, one spinning 0.4 like this, and they're going around. That's not to say that's what the black holes were really doing. That's just one choice that's consistent with what we saw, but lots of choices are consistent with the observation.
And were they equal masses? Or?
Pretty close. The mass ratio is something around 1.2. So it's pretty close to equal mass. So that was perfect for us too, because if the mass ratio had been 10, we wouldn't have been able to do a model of it anytime soon. But so that was just one more way. This was a golden observation for us. Okay. I want to say a little bit about how. Okay, I need to figure out when I need to quit. Okay. Got a few more minutes. 10 minutes? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to show just a few more results that some of my students, of our students at Fullerton, have been involved with. So I have to say a little bit more. I've been loosey-goosey in saying, well, we compare the data to the models. Well, what exactly are we doing when we do that? So it'd be a whole talk to tell you in detail, but the gist is this idea of a Markov chain Monte Carlo method. So basically you pick some random masses and spins and compute a model waveform, compare it to the data. If that matches pretty well, okay, so that's your starting point. Then pick some random points around it. If the better they agree, the more likely you are to say, okay, let's use those instead. And then do that again and again and again, and over time, you spend more time at the points that are more consistent. So you'll get some probability distribution. So this is a distribution of a combination of the components of the black hole spin for a test problem where we hit a numerical relativity wave in the data and pretended it was real. So this red curve, so this green curve is a prior assumption of, because you've got to, you have to start out saying, well, what do we already know about what kinds of spins black holes can have? And this used some simple choice, like all the components are independent and could be anything. This black curve is the result of doing this Markov chain Monte Carlo, and it narrows in and gives you some probability, and then the red one was the true value that we started with. So this gives you an idea of this helps you make sure that there's nothing wrong with your waveforms, that what you put in, you really can do this kind of comparison and get the right answer out. And now, does this work if the black holes are spinning really fast, which is my favorite case because I've been spending so much time trying to model them. So what if the black hole masses are roughly equal and the spins are nearly one? If LIGO saw waves from that case, could we tell doing this kind of comparison that we do? So to find out, working with Katerina Chatsunanu, who's one of our collaborators elsewhere, we ran the numerical relativity calculations, and then she did the LIGO parameter estimation. So here's a case where the black holes are spinning as fast as anyone's been able to simulate before. These were done by one of my former students who's at Caltech now doing his PhD. The spins are 0.9988. The true value of the spins on this plot is this, the blue X, except because it's at the corner, you only see the lower left leg of the X. And then these contours are what the parameter estimation found. They underestimated it a bit, but they got in the ballpark. Here's a case the other way around where the black hole's spins are down. and
so up and down is relatively
similar? Yeah, so I should have drawn an arrow maybe instead of this. So like orbit is up here and orbit is up here. So that's what I mean by down. Sorry about that. and in this case, here's the true value. And it got in the ballpark, but it undershot the magnitude somewhat. So if we saw something like this, we might not know quite how fast, but we know we saw something spinning pretty fast. Here's a case like the simulation I just showed you where they're spinning in opposite directions. And in that case, these are the true values and these are the contours. They're way off. The problem is when the spins are opposite like this, they kind of cancel each other out in the leading order effects they have on the gravitational wave. And it's harder to tell the difference between that and that they're not spinning at all. So you could have black holes that are spinning really fast, but if the spins are in the wrong directions, then you might not know it. Here's another way of looking at it. This effective spin, this is the specific combination of the spin it is. It's the component of the spin of each black hole along the orbital angular momentum L weighted by the masses. And you could say, how well can we infer that? Well, for these cases where the spins are pointing in the same direction, that has a big influence on the waveform. Basically, when the spins are like this, it takes longer to merge, and when they're like this, they merge faster. And that imprints itself on the wave, so you can see it more easily. These contours here undershoot what the true answer is, but they're in the ballpark. But for these two cases, the true answer, it gets the true answer much better, because this combination is nearly zero. So when LIGO says we see no evidence for spin, what we've seen is all of the spins we've seen, with maybe one exception, this combination is consistent with zero. But you get a very similar contour for these two cases, where this one's hardly spinning and this one's spinning really fast.
If cosmic censorship was real, and there were objects that make it singularities and spin bigger than n, would you be able to see
it? I don't know, for kind of an interesting reason. So let me skip ahead to try to get at that. We've tried to see if we could create anything in our simulations with spins bigger than one. And we failed, but we tried. And let me show you what happened. There's two things that went wrong. So this was this simulation I was telling you about where the spins are nearly one in the same direction. And this is the spin versus time. So this is actually 8 pi times the spin over the area. This is the thing that with these theorems should be less than or equal to 1. So here it is at 0.9. The actual spin over mass squared is like 0.994. This thing is 0.9. Near merger, it starts dropping. The black holes start absorbing energy and gaining area of the horizon. And then this, when this black hole is created, and it's got this weird peanut shape, and you measure this spin over mass squared, it's big, it's almost 1, but as close as we can get to when this horizon first appears, it's less. And this was the most extreme case we could get to. So we tried making a black hole like this. But you might say, well, how do you even know you know how to measure spin in this case, because it's so far from axis symmetry? So we tried something else, just in initial data. So let me show you what's going on here. I brought a bunch of things up. Let me unpack this. This is the kind of system we're making, equal masses and just changing the spin, but it's the same spin on both black holes. And what we tried to do was change a parameter in our initial data to crank the spin on the black holes up. And let's see if we can even make initial data that starts out with a spin bigger than one. It's not going to be in equilibrium maybe, but let's just try it. So this is some knob we turn, a parameter in our numerics, and then 8 pi spin over area is the red curve. And sure enough, we're able to drive that above 1. But you see how the curve splits here? Here's what happens. When you do that, this is the surface in our elliptic equations where we set a boundary condition and made it spin faster than 1. But before you turn it up enough for it to spin bigger than 1, this other surface that's also outgoing, it's a marginally trapped surface, which is now the outermost marginally trapped surface, which is actually the horizon, hides the one that's spinning too fast. So you could evolve this, but there's this less than one surface that spontaneously shows up to hide the one you forced to be bigger than one. So that's what really went wrong, was trying to evolve something like this at all and see what happened. So it's a great question. To answer it, we would need some model of what the waves would look like, and in ordinary relativity, nobody's figured out how to do that yet.
Naked
singularities are an even bigger problem from relativity, because how are you going to deal with the singularity? How are you going to evolve it? I'm going to stop with just one more movie. So far, most of what I've been talking about is just what are the black hole masses and spins at the beginning and at the end. But you might want to know, what is the space-time doing in the middle when it's all interesting and stormy? And that's a really hard question to answer. It's hard to come up with things that don't just completely change when you change your coordinates to try to measure stuff near the horizons. So a bunch of us a few years ago, led by Rob Owen and Kip Thorne and a few others, had this idea to try to draw some lines that are analogous to electric field lines. So these are called Tendex lines. Basically, if you're an observer and you're oriented like this, you would be stretched if you're along a red line, and you'd be squeezed if you're tangent to a blue line. In an original draft, these pictures were not clip art, they were Stephen Hawking, but the journal said no, so change them to these. And then you can draw pictures like this that look some like some analog. There's three lines going through each point, so you choose some to draw. And basically, there's two directions you're stretched and one direction you're squeezed for this spherical black hole. This is the first time we've had a movie of two non-spinning black holes falling together head-on, and then we can watch how these lines are evolving, and you can see them sort of joining up here. And that tells you something about how observers at different parts of the space-time would feel the gravity there. Okay, so those are just a few of the things that some of the students and I have been up to in the gravity group at Cal State Fullerton. And I guess I went up to the end, but if there's time for questions now or afterwards, I'm happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Maybe before we ask questions, I'll just quickly say we're going to go for dinner tonight around, probably leave from here around 6 o'clock, around then. So if you're interested, then let me know.
I have to head off because I'm illegally parked.
I appreciate you taking that risk to watch the talk. Thank you.
I came in especially. I couldn't find
Thank you.
But you're going to talk, but I couldn't find a parking spot.
Questions? Nice to see you again.
Oh, nice to see you. Nice to meet you in person. Yes, okay.
Great talk.
Thank you very much.
So if you're using spectral methods, do you worry about something like a Gibbs phenomenon? Or
yes.
Reasons not to.
That's a wonderful question. So basically, yes, you do. So basically, when I was comparing these methods, I left one thing out. I only alluded to it briefly in words. I said you can't do matter with spectral methods. Gibbs phenomenon is why. So basically, the beautiful properties that you have with these spectral methods, and these pictures are meant to say just in this region, you take a linear function plus a quadratic function or whatever, some basis functions to represent it. And the problem is, if there's a discontinuity or a sharp feature there, then you'll get Gibbs phenomena when you do it. And that destroys your ability to handle things like surfaces of stars. So actually, what we actually do when we want to put a neutron star in our simulations, here's one with a fast black hole, is see this little gray square there? That's a finite difference grid that's less accurate, converges slower, that we have to have for the matter. And not only that, we got to keep interpolating back and forth between the square that the matter's on and then the spectral cells that we use for the space-time curvature. It's horribly slow. If we want to get more accuracy, even on better computers in the future, we need a brand new code. And my students and I are contributing to a project to build a new code that uses a new method called discontinuous Galerkin. And I don't have time to go into the details, but basically it's like spectral methods. It has the same convergence advantages when you're smooth. But instead of taking your series expansion and then just evolving it right away, you integrate over the volume of each cell and use Gauss's law to get some surface integrals at the boundaries between cells, and you can adjust those numerically just so you can handle things like surfaces of stars. So it's a wonderful question, and yeah, Gibbs phenomena are the bane of spectral methods, and that's why we need to do a whole new code to try to do matter with this kind of accuracy. And did you have a question?
So you talked about various spin alignments and so forth. Mm-hmm. Just from the, presumably these black holes start on the way apart and there's some post-Newtonian expansion. Is there no evolution that tends to make spins align or misalign?
I think it's something of an open question. There certainly are models. If you've got like a circumbinary disk or some matter that they're evolving through, that can tend to align them. But I think the jury's still out whether that's what you see in nature or not. All we can say right now from our gravitational wave observations is the combination of spin we can measure tends to be small. We can't really say whether, we haven't seen any evidence of precession, so maybe all the spins that are there are aligned, but it could be that we're just not sensitive enough yet. But I don't think I don't think there's anything conclusive yet on whether we know for sure that those methods, mechanisms for aligning them actually are what dominates.
So the range of masses for the black holes and LIGO scene, like these several tens of solar masses, how does this fit in with like models, you know, astrophysical models of black hole production?
Yeah, so that's a little outside of what I'm used to thinking about, but the gist is they would have to form in some model where you can't blow enough matter off when the stars are forming, and that turns out to tend to mean you want lower metallicity environments. So if you're going to make black holes like this, this is an area of active research now, but they're starting to look at, well, are these black holes coming from something with less metal? But that's getting past what I know. So it's an interesting question, and that's the one little bit that I can point you to.
So for a while, there were also models where, if you just go back to your picture of the various black holes merging, where you can actually start with the high metallicity stars and then merge a couple of times, and suddenly you had a 40.
Yeah.
Are those models no longer in favor? And for a while, they were sort of equally likely, people thought, with the...
I wish I knew the answer to that. I don't know the answer to that. I think there's...
Your plot where you have the various... All the black holes, it sort of shows that...
Yeah.
If you just look at that, on the surface, it's plausible you can just build them up. Of course, it depends on populations and interaction rates and all that kind of thing.
Well, the thing is, though... if it's true that might be true, I think first it's an area of ongoing research? Like, some people say, well, before LIGO saw these, there were some theory papers saying here's a way you could form them, but it wasn't yet convincing that that was really a mechanism that happened in the real world. The other thing is, though, if it turns out to be true that these black holes aren't, that we're seeing aren't spinning, and it's not just that the spins are in some direction we can't, we're not really sensitive to, if they're really not spinning, then they didn't come from mergers. Right. Because when you merge, the orbital angular momentum goes into spin, and even two equal mass non-spinning black holes will give you a spin of 0.7 when they merge, basically, roughly. So it could be with some more observations and more sensitivity we could get in on that. But that's all I could say right now.
How does what you've seen tell us about how rare these black hole binary theories, you must have some estimates on how long it takes to inspire and so forth, you know, are there going to be several of these in each galaxy, or are they
rare? So I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but there are companion publications that come out when we announce detections that will answer exactly that question and tell you per cubic gigaparsec per year how often do we think this happens. I don't know specifically about their relation to where the galaxies are, but if you want to know what these numbers mean about rates, we have our best estimates, but they change a lot because we only have 10 data points, and every time we see something new, all those rates are going to adjust for a little while. But I don't know the numbers in those units. What I do know is we expect at our next sensitivity that they happen enough that on average we think when the detectors turn on again in March, we'll see as much as one a month. And when we're at our design sensitivity, we expect they happen enough we could see one a week. But putting that back into per cubic gigaparsec per year, I'm not sure.
You worried about your catalog numbers when you start seeing several per day?
I think we'll turn to our astronomer friends and they'll tell us whether it should be like an A, B, or like a 1, 2 or something. It'll be all right. The bigger problem is when it gets to 2100, and then we're going to need to change that 2-digit year in the front, I guess. I mean, we laugh about this, but actually when we made the first discovery, I only heard this third hand, maybe this isn't true, but what I heard was someone in some international astronomers something or other that decides to make standards for things like this told us we really should rethink how we're naming these things, and they would like to have some input on how the official astronomical designation of these things. But we just called it the event when we were talking about it. Because, there were lots of different nicknames, but that was the one that emerged. It's 1,000 scientists who are, some of us are feel very strongly about things. So there even was a wiki page with suggested nicknames, but that had nothing to do with it because everyone just called it the event. It just sort of emerged. And then we had to give it an official name, and it was a gravitational wave and the date, but I don't know who decided that's what we're going to do. But yeah, we'll probably just put an A, B. We should be so lucky. That's a wonderful problem to have.
I'm sure we can ask questions in comparison to what we've got. Let's thank the speaker again.